Okay, so today is March 25th, 2013. I am at the Teamster headquarters in Detroit, Michigan. My name is Dan Patton. I'm with John Peralta, and we are doing this interview in conjunction with the Detroit newspaper strike project for the Reuther Library. Okay, so if I could have you start off with just saying your name and your current title and position.
Sure. My name is John Peralta. I'm now a business representative for IBT 372. We merged from Local 24 in 2007, and I went from the president of the local to a business representative. But I also am also I wear two hats there. I'm an international representative with the International Brotherhood of Teamsters, who represents newspaper workers across the country.
Okay, and so where are you from originally? Where were you born?
I was born in Detroit, and we moved to Sterling Heights in 1959. And I lived in Sterling Heights up until 2006.
Okay. And?
Which I was like, I worked at the Detroit News plant on 16 and Mound, and I worked 1 mile from the plant when I worked there. And because I was an officer also, I also worked for the union downtown. Okay. So I was a part-time officer at the time.
And did you have a union background in your family?
No, not at all.
No, you were the first in your family to to get involved. Okay, so then how did you become involved with the Detroit newspapers and the Teamsters?
Well, my brother-in-law actually, back in 1973, got me up my first couple shifts in the mailroom, and I started in November of 1974 as a part-time mailroom employee, which what we do is we package and bundle the paper and send it out to the drivers, and they put it together. The pressmen print the paper, and it comes to our room, and we assemble and distribute to the drivers, or it's actually packaged and sent to the drivers. We also do the Sunday comics and all the preprints that are put together in packages and sent out to the consumer. Those are all your insert ads, like Target, Myers, Kmart, things like that. So there's not just print. There's two different types of print. There's what they call ROP, which is right off the press. And then there's inserts that are preprints. Someone else prints them and brings them to our mailroom, and we put them together. And for instance, when you get your Sunday paper, all the Sunday ads you see in that little comic, those are all done by us.
Okay. So you started off doing that, and so then how did you move up through the ranks?
Oh, I'm sorry. I wasn't sure you wanted to know that. In about 1978, a good friend of mine was the vice president of the local, and he said he would like me to get involved and become an executive board member because there's going to be an opening. And he knew I was very interested because I used to go to every union meeting every Sunday that we had. So he said I had the qualifications just because I went to the union meetings. So when the opening occurred, we had an election, and I won the election, and I became an executive board member in 1978. That was my first position. And in today's reality, because we were in a different union at the time, it was called, would be considered what a trustee would be today in the Teamsters Union. And then my second position, 2 months later, I moved to recording secretary, which the recording secretary takes down all the notes and minutes and keeps, you know, track of all that stuff for the union monthly. And I was there until, I believe, 1991. I became the vice president of my local, where until 1995 I stayed the vice president when the newspaper strike started.
And so in 1995 you were the vice president?
Correct.
Let's see. So, going through that process, then, what was the Teamster position and sort of the feeling within your local of the JOA?
Well, when the JOA was enforced, or what came about, we tried to intervene as much as possible. It came apparent that it looked like the JOA was going to go through. We were pretty smart because we negotiated a 14-point piece where it protected our people in 14 different ways. And I don't remember every piece of it, but basically it was employment. We had secured some kind of overtime positions. And secured seniority. Now, because the news and the Free Press were two separate companies, they were forming one, we agreed to a dovetail of seniority where we would mix our seniorities, blend it from each shop, because at that time we represented both shops, so it wouldn't have been fair for us to take the news people, which at the time were the ones that became we're the dominant paper, and they said that, you know, they didn't actually terminate it. So anyway, we wound up dovetailing our seniority, and we had a bunch of different things, and I wish I would have thought, I would have tried to remember that 14-point plan, but actually that was done in 1987, I believe, and that was one of the reasons we stopped being interveners. Once we got that plan, it protected us for a period of time. And from 1987 to like 1992, things were really good. I mean, as far as the union part, we had a really good relationship with the company, and they were making money, we were making money. But it wasn't until 1992 that we started to notice a difference, and there was the reason there was a difference. Late in 1991, just before Christmas, they hired a new CEO, and his name was Frank Vega. And he sent out a letter, or he put in his front page of the newspaper for Christmas, and it was kind of like the news, it was like a real shock to the employees. Like, he was coming in and he was going to change everything, and he hasn't even met any of us, and he wound up making it sound like he was threatening us, basically, in a newspaper article that he put out in Christmas Day, and that was 1992. So we went through the 92 negotiations with the new CEO, Frank Vega, and the mailroom wound up keeping its old contract pretty much intact. Because at the time, they wanted to try to change a lot of the things in our contract, and they couldn't do it because they weren't prepared. They did, however, my sister local at the time was Local 372, which we belong to now. They had quite a bit of changes in their contract, and they agreed to them, and it was a mutual agreement, and everything was fine. And we kind of felt like they were looking to go after us in 92, but they weren't prepared. So what we wound up doing was we accepted our old contract and we moved on until 1995.
So you said that 372 is your sister organization. How much did the two locals interact?
We were very close. The principal officer of that local, Al Deary, and the principal officer of my local, Alex Young, they both interacted every day. We had meetings with them all the time, you know, all of us did. And we also had what a lot of newspaper unions don't have across the country, which is called the Metro Council of Newspaper Unions. And the Metro Council Newspaper Unions consisted of, at that time, six locals. One was our local, the mailers. The second one was the press room. The third one was the driver's department, which is IBT Local 372. The pressman was Local 13N. The guild was called the Detroit Guild. And then we had the typographical union, which represented the people in typos. I think that's six. Mm-hmm. It is, right? Mm-hmm. And so anytime we negotiated wages and things like that, we went in with the company and negotiated jointly. But our non-economics were always bargained separately, and so that's what we did, and we actually still do that today. But there's less locals involved since we've had mergers and things like that.
That was going to be my next question. How, you know, what was the dynamic within the MC and you, in terms of cooperation?
We were very tight, very strong, and we still are today. We've gone through a lot, and we've always stayed together. Now, previous to that strike, there was problems, but that wasn't with the new administration, because somewhere around 1992, a lot of different officers became the new officers of the locals, and that was including me and Al Young and another guy named Jim St. Louis, who was the secretary treasurer of my local at the time. We were all young, very young, and we thought the important thing to do was stick together and make sure that we were all on the same page, and we always had council meetings. Anything we did it as a council, as we do today, believe it or not. We still do it all these 18 years later.
So in when contract negotiations came up again in March 95, what was the, could you describe the situation with those negotiations and sort of the talk of outsourcing and the WARN notification?
Well, basically they were threatening to outsource all the mailroom work, and at the time we knew it was kind of unrealistic for them. But they wanted to take our work and bring it to Allentown, Pennsylvania. And what we were doing, it would have been very costly, a truck from Allentown, Pennsylvania, all the way to Detroit. But that was the threat at the time. They also, at the time, were trying to make some more major changes in IBT 372, which was drivers in circulation. And they had 125 different issues with that particular local. The mailroom, we were working through our issues, and we were pretty close, believe it or not, out of all the unions. And we had some issues, but I think we could have possibly got an agreement with the company, and it wouldn't have included outsourcing. But the major problem is that happened was they tried to impose something on the newspaper guild, which was called merit pay, which people would get paid for merit, and the newspaper guild was very much opposed to the merit system for their workers. Well, the Detroit News, who was owned by Gannett at the time, told the guild that they were at impasse and that they were going to invoke the merit pay system on the workers there. And that is pretty much what actually triggered the strike. A lot of people don't know that. A lot of people think other things took place, like money and stuff like that, that we weren't happy with what we were going to get. But it wasn't an economic strike. It was the fact that they were trying to invoke a new system on the guild, and actually the Teamsters were there to support the guild. Now, Local 372 had a lot of issues that they had on the table, but I think those could have been resolved. And unfortunately, what took place was somewhere down the road, the company decided to try to push our buttons, and they pressed them with the guild. And we were willing to, support the guild workers, because no matter what, if they were going to do something to them, then the next step would have been to us. And that's why we did it. I mean, we thought it was important for all the unions to stick together, because there was five other small craft unions that actually broke off the console probably 5 years before that strike, and they were the electrical workers, the machinists, and operating engineers. And they only represented 140 people, and we represented at the time 2,400, and they broke off from us because they were just kind of pretty much taking care of themselves.
So, what was the What was the initial response, just in your local, to that that contract negotiation and that sort of threat?
Well, we were back. We just took the position that we were going to stick with our union brothers and sisters from the other locals. At the time, like I said, I think we could have possibly gotten an agreement. It wouldn't have been a great agreement, but we could have gotten one that we could have lived with that would have been okay. But unfortunately, that didn't take place because of what they tried to do to the guild and what they were trying to do to 372, our sister local, which is the other Teamster local at the time. Now, the pressmen were not in the Teamsters then. They were called the GCIU. They were Graphic Communication International Union. And it was in 2005 when those people merged with us, the Teamsters. So now they're merged with the Teamsters and our Teamsters, but at the time they were not. So the two Teamster locals were IBT 372 and IBT 2040. But we stood behind all the unions as one, and so did the other unions. They did the same thing, because the pressmen were close on an agreement, and if they wanted to, they could have gotten one and broke the council unions, but they wouldn't do it, just as we didn't do it.
And how were you involved in this process of the contract negotiation?
Well, I was one of the key people on the negotiating committee.
So were there any other strategies outside of striking that were sort of developed after that spring of 95?
We didn't want to go on strike, and we were always hoping that we wouldn't have to go on strike. The problem was, is at the time, we knew that we could do a consumer and advertiser boycott, where people wouldn't buy the newspaper, and also we would go to advertisers and ask them to stop advertising. That was quite successful in a few strikes previous to our strike, so we were looking at that strategy, but the problem is it would have been very hard to invoke that if we didn't strike. It wouldn't have been as effective. In other words, if we would have stayed in and worked and tried to do that. So we took the position that if we needed to, that we would actually strike. But we always kept in mind that behind the back of all our minds was the fact that we wanted to get a contract that, you know, that we could live with, because no one wanted to strike. Unfortunately, the company decided that they thought they could break the unions at the time, and they wound up hiring like 1,500 strike breakers that they had waiting in hotel rooms. They hired two security firms that they used during the strike that actually guarded their trucks and their plants. And these people were like hired mercenaries. They were very nasty.
How did you come to find out about these strike breaking sort of groups?
Well, it was just known. I don't remember exactly how we found out. You know, we had our intel, but obviously the company wanted us to know. We also know that they met with the Sterling Heights police. Now, this is interesting because here we are. It's like March. Our contracts didn't expire. I don't remember when our contracts were due to expire, but it was way before we even started negotiations. They met in January of 1995 with the Sterling Heights Police Department, and they set up a strike program with them. And they also told them that they would buy them equipment that they needed for the strike. And they wound up actually purchasing riot gear and things like that for the newspapers. I mean, for the police department in Sterling Heights. And we did find out about them. We also met with the Sterling Heights police in March while negotiations were going on. And they took a very hard line with us, telling us what they were going to do. And we were like thinking, wow, why would they do this? Who are they to tell us, you know, how we are going to handle our strike? And we were kind of, and besides that, it was so early on that no one was even contemplating there would be a strike. So by that happening, it seemed like the company knew that they wanted to strike. They wanted us to strike them. That was what they were looking for. That was their ultimate goal, to strike, for the unions to strike them. Okay.
So you said your local office and even your home and your workplace were all sort of in the same area.
No, our local office was here in Detroit.
Oh, okay.
Same place, but I worked a mile from your plant.
Okay, I see. So then what was sort of the feeling within the community then with this police presence and sort of this...
Now you're talking after the strike started?
Well, I was talking before the strike when, you're working in the area and working with the police, or talking with the police, and they're already preparing.
Mm-hmm.
Sort on the community level, as being a member of the community, and the being your police department. Sort of, what was the feeling there?
Well, at the time we had there was people on the Sterling Heights City Council who were sympathetic to the unions. And we met with those people and talked with them, but they had a person whose name is Duchesne, and he was the city manager. He was the one who was actually in charge of the whole thing, and they had the chief of police at the time was a guy named DeRosha, and this man, he was very military style person. He pulled no punches. And Duchesne also was very company orientated, so it seemed like they were in bed with the newspaper back then. But it didn't really, we didn't really start seeing how the community was going to react until actually the strike started. The community was definitely behind us, and most of the community was definitely behind us, because we were able to get approximately, pretty much from the start of the newspaper, at the time they had like 1,400,000 circulation, or no, about 1,000,002, and we got them, they lost about 350,000 pretty much almost simultaneously after the strike. It was a third of their circulation that was lost due to the strike. We were able to get a lot of the advertisers to pull their ads. Mostly was auto dealers, so they were losing advertising revenue. They lost 350,000 subscribers, but they still kept going, and that really didn't seem to make them budge on anything.
How much preparation was there for the strike?
How much? It's hard to remember. Because the strike happened like in July, and we prepared. We had weekly meetings, we had membership meetings, but it was one of those things that took place rather quickly. So I can't exactly tell you how much preparation took. We met with community leaders and things like that to talk to them about the strike at least a month prior, and we met with different places like unemployment, food banks, different ways to help our members, so in case there was a strike. But the actual preparation of a strike, it took a lot of it happened after, as far as the boycotts and things like that, because we didn't want to ask for people to stop taking the newspaper and the advertisers to stop advertising while we were working for the company. So that took place pretty much after the strike started. But we did compile a list of advertisers and subscribers and things like that. We were doing that all along while we were in negotiations. I'd say probably 2 months worth of prep work as far as finding out who was advertising, who was subscribing, and things like that.
What was sort of your organization's view of the outside support of the strike, as far as from the community, the state, and on the national level?
Believe it or not, it was an incredible amount of support. One of the things that it was incredible. I don't know how to explain it, because if this would have happened today, unfortunately, the unions that helped us back in 95, a lot of them wouldn't have the resources to help, because back in 95, things were doing really well for the unions and the community in whole. But I can tell you that the UAW, the labor unions, like the labor construction unions, the post office unions, almost every union that was around, they gave us tremendous support. And it happened very quickly, because like I told you, we pretty much got them to lose 350,000 subscribers in a very short period of time. And most of that was union people. The finances that we received was an incredible amount of money. But UAW didn't have one person in the strike, and they adopted our strikers every holiday during the strike. They wound up giving our people holiday cash so that they had extra money over and above the strike payments they were receiving from the internationals. And that was an incredible move on the UAW's part, because it was unprecedented at the time. No one did things like that. And then we had the AFL-CIO that had a fund. They pledged $1 million to our support, you know, to fight the strike, because they knew how important the strike was to the union movement.
So we talked about sort of a preparation. Once the strike was underway, was there or can you talk about sort of the strategy for the strike? We've touched on some things, but
The main strategy that I was part of, and I was part the biggest part to me, and the most important part, was the advertiser and consumer boycott of the reading of the paper. That was our main way of getting to the company. Because the philosophy in the newspaper industry is they make their money, the newspapers make their money off of how many people buy the paper, not because they're making a lot of revenue from selling it, because that's how they set their ad rates for their customers. So the more customers they have, the higher they can charge for ad rates. So that was the reason we went after the people buying the newspaper and cut their newspaper approximately 33% down. And then the advertisers that were advertising, a lot of car dealers pulled their ads, and I don't remember which ones. I do remember two specifically, Jerome Duncan Ford, which is no longer in business, but they were taken over by a company called Suburban Ford, and then Royal O'Brien Ford in St. Clair Shores. And I wish I would have thought, because there was others that also helped us, but we did get more support from the auto dealers than we did from most of the other advertisers. There were small mom and pop shops that stopped advertising. Immediately, Best Buy stopped advertising, so did Kmart, which is another unprecedented thing. It's very hard to get national advertisers not to advertise in a paper, and we were successful in getting them to pull. Also, the Teamsters had contracts with Farmer Jacks and Kroger's, and we were able to get Farmer Jacks and Kroger's. Now, this was crucial because they put ads in the actual newspaper, not inserts. And that's where they make their money. That's like, it was very expensive ads. These are full page, one or two or three full page ads, three, four times a week from both of these stores. And they pulled their ads, and they pulled them all the way through the strike. So some of the advertisers stuck with us through the whole thing. But then there was advertisers like Art Van and ABC Warehouse that would not pull their ads, and they never would. And they were actually advertising. Art Van actually decided to help the newspapers and advertise more with them during our strike. And the funny thing was, Art Van was one of my main people that I used to use to buy my furniture for my house and things like that. And so was ABC Warehouse, another place I used to go to buy my appliances and things like that. And after they did that, to this day, 18 years later, they have never gotten a dime from me. I've never purchased one thing from them, either advertiser, because they took a nasty stance. They wouldn't even support us for a little period of time.
So you mentioned like Kmart and Kroger pulling their ads. Did they also stop like carrying the newspaper in terms of selling the newspapers in their stores and their?
You know, that I can't remember.
Okay.
I'm sorry.
No.
I don't remember that. I think they might have, but it's hard to say, you know. Now, that was another aspect that we did, and I'm glad you mentioned that. Mm-hmm. We would go to all the different stores and ask them not to sell the paper. And that wasn't part of what I did, but we were quite successful getting a lot of stores to pull their ads. Now, I can tell you that another thing that happened during the newspaper strike, every newspaper box was pulled from every auto plant in the whole area. Mm-hmm. And that happened very quickly. And oh, the other thing we used to do, and this is another important strategy of the strike, we formed what was called the Speakers Bureau. And we had approximately 30 people on the Speakers Bureau. And what they would do is they would go around and they would talk to the community about the strike. We would go to weekly union meetings, monthly union meetings. We would speak at different places like VFW, anywhere where there was some kind of community organization going on, and explaining to the people what was happening in the newspaper strike and why we struck, and we were looking for support, and we would get financial support that way also, and that was very effective.
Yeah, that's what I was just going to ask. So with these sort of, for lack of a better word, these sort of, street level activities, was there a feeling that there was some progress being made?
Well, the problem is there was all the things that we did were very beneficial to an ending. But it took a very long time because this company had deep pockets. So you're talking about Gannett and Knight Ridder. They were so profitable that they could absorb the losses here in Detroit. Instead of them making, like, just using round numbers, $1 million 1 year, they made $600,000 or whatever it was. And back then, the money that they made was a much larger amount than things are today, you know, because you're talking so many years ago. Mm-hmm. But I think we affected them to lose, like in the first year, $1 million. And they were, like in 1995, they were on their way to profiting over $54,000. Now, before that, all took place up in the 90s, they weren't really making a lot of money. It wasn't until the last couple of years, when the JOA first came in place in 1987, they still were at a deficit. But after they figured out, you know, how to get rid of the double customers and the double TV guides and all the things that were happening back then. They actually used to have two magazines that went in the paper and things like that. And they cut it back to one. And they finally figured out how to streamline the paper a little bit, because what they had to do is take two newspapers and put it into one for their Sunday circulation. And what you have to understand is the Sunday circulation was the backbone of the newspaper. That's what we did. We did the inserts. At the time, we had approximately 320 people full-time in the mailroom and another 400 on a contingent list of workers that worked part-time. So it was quite a big operation. That was just as far as the mailroom. And then the pressman had probably 200 or 300 people working the pressman. And I don't know, I think we had 1,300 or 1,400 in driver's circulation, which was IBT Local 372. So it was quite a big operation. And as time went by, they streamlined and they're starting to become more profitable. And that profit was actually just starting in 1994. And in 1995, they decided to go on strike, which was very foolish for them, because instead of becoming profitable that year, they were on their way of their first year of making $100,000. They wound up losing quite a bit. And I don't know exactly how much they lost the first year, but it was not worth what they lost. The circulation loss, the advertising loss, definitely hurt them, because at that time there wasn't an internet, okay? And then in 1998, the internet started to arise and become like a competitor of theirs. And now they had a natural loss of subscribers and things that they didn't count on. So had the strike not taken place, they would have had 350,000 more customers to work off that base instead of losing 300, say you had 1.2 million, you know, and you lose 5% a year, of that would have been a lot less than losing 350,000 and then losing your 5% or whatever they lost during those times of the internet market, which drastically cut into their ROP, which is where they made their money, their classified ads.
So back to the sort of the beginning of the strikes, you know, we talked about the boycotts and what about picketing? What role did your organization have in
that?
Well,
we said we had people that their duty was to picket. Mm-hmm. You know, we had people that are there 24 hours around the clock, pretty much at every site. Because at the time there was a plant in Detroit and there was a plant in Sterling Heights, and we had to cover two driveways in Sterling Heights, only one in Detroit. Mm-hmm. So we covered those driveways. But the problem with picketing was a visual thing, because you could not actually stop the papers from leaving the building, because it was just impossible with the amount of people we had. And we had an injunction against us because we had a couple mass demonstrations in August and September of 95 that we actually, one night, it was Labor Day 1995, we wound up stopping the papers from going out almost all night. They actually brought helicopters in to get their papers out. It was an incredible night that night. It was very successful. Now they claim that they still got the paper out, and yes, they got some papers out, but they did not get the paper out as they normally would have. But we had approximately 4,000 people on the picket line that day, and it was an incredible moment in labor history, because unions from all over the country came in and helped us with that day. But previous to that, August 31st of 95, we had quite a few people. It was a Saturday night, and we had quite a few people on the picket line in Sterling Heights. And there was a couple of melees with the Sterling Heights police that night. And actually, this one particular night, they dragged a person across the street and they arrested him, saying he resisted arrest when all he was doing was picketing. It was horrible that night. The police department came over in a V formation and plowed right through the people to open up the line. It was unbelievable. Have you ever seen any video on it?
Yeah, a little bit.
Yeah.
Were you ever present for any of those?
Oh yeah,
strikes?
I was there every one.
Yep.
Yeah. I actually did a lot of videotaping during the strike, because what was happening, the police were videoing us, and they edited their tapes, and they would never show the entire tape. And they would make it look like somebody was doing something against something. And so what I would do is, when we were on those picket lines, I would dump videotape and make sure people seen what was really going on. And one particular night, it was right after the 4,000 just demonstration, was the Saturday night before Labor Day. We had 4,000 people in front of the plant, and we were very successful, like I told you. Well, we had a big rally downtown in Labor Day, and which was a Monday, and we had a whole bunch of workers there, and they said, we want to go back out and help you guys, you know. And we told them, look, we did really well Saturday night. We just, you know, let things go. But a lot of people didn't want that. They wanted to go out and help us. So they went to the plant, and it was Labor Day night in 1995. And we actually had a small group of people there. And then all of a sudden, more came. And then it was probably 300 or 400 people were on our picket line helping us. And they were successful in stopping trucks from going through. But the police department wasn't happy with that, and they decided to tear gas us and use brute force to get those lines open. They actually came over in their V formation. They had tear gas. They had all kinds of stuff they used, their shields, batons, to get through. Pepper spray was another big thing they used. And that night they opened up the line, and once they opened it up, they told everybody that they had to leave or else they were going to arrest anyone on the premise. So they started pushing people with their shields to have them move. And what they were doing is people were walking in front of them, and they were taking the shields and actually pushing people, knocking them over. Well, that particular night, I had my video camera with me, and I was on the sidelines, and they were all stopped. And anywhere I seen where they were hurting somebody, I was videotaping. Well, I caught this one, I seen this one thing out of the corner of my eye, and I started to videotape, and one of the police officers who was in front of me made a gesture to me and said, "Mr. Peralta, always with your camera, blah, blah, blah," saying something to me. And they were spraying pepper spray on us and stuff, and I was actually getting pepper sprayed while I was videotaping. But I happened to catch this one thing with my camera, and I had a really great zoom lens, and I zoomed in on 5 police officers. And they were on top of this one individual, and they were handcuffing him, and he was laying on the ground, and they were saying he was resisting arrest. Well, while he was on the ground, they were kicking him and punching him, and they beat the crap out of this guy. So, now I couldn't tell that from that little monitor that was on my camera. Well, the next morning, I got a call from my friend, and he said, "John, by any chance, did you get any video?" And I said, "I did get some last night, yes." He says, "Well, last night the cops arrested me and they beat the hell out of me." And I said, "Really?" I said, "Oh, I don't know. I don't recall getting you on tape." Well, that afternoon, I was watching news coverage, and Channel 7 had shot the video of when they grabbed him. And I couldn't see his face, but I seen his head, the hair. And I looked and I go, "Wow, that's my friend." I said, "I know I got that," but I couldn't tell from my video who it was. Well, after I located the video on my camera, come to find out, it was my friend. And he was one of my workers I worked with for 20 years at the time. So I had the unadulterated video of when he was being grabbed by the police officers up until they arrested him and took him off. And when the police, during his court case, showed their video, it was edited version. It happened after he was on the ground, where my video was right from the start. It was very crucial. And that particular guy, I testified in court for him, and he wound up getting a $1.25 million settlement from the city of Sterling Heights, and he also got a $1.25 million settlement from Detroit newspapers, which I don't know what his final outcome was, but that was the initial ruling. And one of the things that took place during that trial, when I was on the stand, later after the trial was over, the person's sister came up to me and said, two things that happened during that trial. Carl Marlinga's testimony really helped my brother, and your testimony helped my brother. They found what you said very credible, because the police got up there and they were just lying through their teeth, and the jury seen it. And when I got up there and I played my tape and explained everything that was going on during that period of time, they could see from what the police supplied that they did have all edited stuff and that everything they said was a lie. So the jury awarded him a very big settlement, and it was pretty good for him. He was probably the one that got the best settlement out of the whole strike.
So what was then your organization's, after an incident like that, what was your organization's response to that?
This, what do you mean?
You were the vice president, but did the Teamsters the MCNU in general, did they continue to support the picketing, or was there
at that point, that night was very crucial for the company because they were successful in getting an injunction against us. We wanted to still have the picketing, but then they limited us to 10 people, and that was what the reason it happened was that night. Okay, and that night was not good because of that, but then we were limited to 10 people on the picket line. But like I told you, the picketing wasn't really it was almost impossible to shut this newspaper down. We weren't really trying to do that. We were trying to be more effective on the consumer boycott and the advertiser boycott. Now, after that took place, then what we would do is we would go to their distribution centers and we would form picket lines on Saturday night and make it hard for the carriers to bring the newspapers out. So there was more effort, but it wasn't at the plant anymore. It moved to the distribution centers. And we couldn't cover all of them. We could only go to one or two per week. And it was the Sunday paper we were really trying to affect. So there was a lot of different things. It wasn't just, like, there was no one thing we did, you know? We did so many different things that it was so hard. It was hard to explain because, you know, Saturday night was the picket for the distribution centers. Then Sunday morning we'd have to picket people selling the papers. And then during the week we went to the advertisers and hand-billed the advertisers, not the advertise in the paper. So it was always an ongoing process of a few different things. On top of that, then there was the community support and the rallies we would have to try to keep the momentum going. And then we did other things that I haven't even talked to you about. We started doing civil disobedience and things like that. And that was more downtown at the downtown plant, where we actually had Marianne Mahaffey get arrested for us. You remember her? She was,
Could you tell me a little bit more about that then?
Well, that was another structure that we came up with, that we were trying to keep a light on the strike. So in other words, we didn't want the community to think the strike was over. So we would do these types of actions to let people know and get community support. And it was pretty much the only way we could get the media to come out and cover us, because they wouldn't cover you at a art van or at a car dealer who was advertising, because that was too nice and peaceful. So you had to do what was called civil disobedience and get people arrested. And we had quite a few people arrested that were big. The biggest one was Congressman David Bonnier. He was arrested for us. Marianne Mahaffey. We had the
Marianne Mahaffey was city council.
She was mayor pro tem at the time.
Of Detroit.
Right. And she was big. I mean, she had a lot of influence. And she was actually out on her, a lot of times she was out on her Saturday night things watching the Detroit police, because a lot of the times these distribution centers were in Detroit. And the Detroit police would come out and try to keep the trucks so they could go in and out. And she was there watching her police officers to make sure that they didn't use brute fatality. Now, to be very honest with you, the Detroit police treated us 10 times better than the Sterling Heights police. The Sterling Heights police were bought and paid for. They got over $2 million during a short period of time from the Detroit newspapers to cover their overtime costs associated with the strike. And they had this thing set up across the street called Treasure Island, we called it Treasure Island. It was the center of Mound Road, where the police would actually just park their cars and look at us and watch us on the picket line. And the minute somebody did something wrong, they were over there going to arrest us, you know. We didn't talk about the very first night of the strike, and that was very crucial too, because the very first night of the strike, we had a humongous rally that we had right downtown here in Detroit. It started at 8 o'clock. Our strike started 8 p.m. July 13, 1995, and we had a big rally downtown. Well, we also had some people at the picket lines in Sterling Heights, but within 10 minutes of our strike starting, this is very important, 9 people were arrested by the Sterling Heights police. And actually, that night, they treated them really bad. I mean, you're talking about people who have never been on a picket line before. These police didn't even give them a chance. They didn't even say, okay, if you don't do this, we're going to arrest you, or if you don't do this, let those trucks go through. You know, they just came out there. So we immediately got wind of that, and we brought a whole bunch of people down there. We had a couple hundred people the very first night of the strike in front of Sterling Heights plant. And the very first night, there was another melee that took place. It wasn't as bad as the ones that took place later, but one of our pressmen, who was about 7 foot tall, they targeted him. And they broke his teeth out that night with a shield. And they said that they didn't do it, but he was down laying with his mouth open with his teeth knocked out. And it was horrible. So there were so many things that took place that, now these things, we even did more than this. So, I mean, it's like, it's hard to remember everything, but as I'm talking to you, I'm remembering some of the other things we did. So if there's any other questions about, I'll let you figure out where you're at.
Yeah, well, okay, so after the injunction against the picketers, then you could only have 10 people in Sterling Heights.
And we pretty much kept to that because...
10 people in Detroit.
Yeah, any picket line.
But...
No, actually, it was only Sterling Heights.
Only Sterling Heights, okay.
Yeah, because Sterling Heights was the one that they won the injunction. Mm-hmm. Because that was where they printed the paper, mm-hmm. mainly. They did print downtown sometimes, but mostly they printed in Sterling Heights. Mm-hmm. That was the main place where their distribution of their Sunday paper went out. Mm-hmm. They had weekly papers going out of the plant in Detroit, mm-hmm. but not, and some Sunday papers, but most of it was done in Sterling Heights. So yeah, the limitation took place in Sterling Heights. And at that point from then, we moved to the distribution centers. That's as far as the picketing piece. Mm-hmm. But like I said, we still did other things. Mm-hmm. We did the civil disobedience. And then we also did some things to advertisers that were different. One day, we had a march, and we would march. We went out to Utica, and there was a whole bunch of different advertisers there that were in a shopping center that continued to advertise. And we took 150 people, and we had T-shirts made. And this was peaceful stuff. It wasn't trying to hurt anybody or anything. But on one side, it said, they attack us today. No, on the front, it said, they attack us today, they'll attack you tomorrow. They target us today, they'll target you tomorrow. That's what the T-shirt said on the front. And then on the back, it said, please do not shop here. Okay, but what we did is we had the T-shirts made so that some had the target you, they target us today, they target you tomorrow on one side of the shirt, and on the other half we had on the other. Mm-hmm. So when people would walk side by side, they were walking like a billboard. So it would say the one message on this shirt, and on the back of the other shirt it would say, please do not shop here. But it was also on their front too. Mm-hmm. So it was like, from front and back, you've seen them. And then we would walk through different stores with these shirts on, 150 people. And it was pretty effective, actually. The advertisers didn't like it.
All right, so I believe it was in August of 96 where there was an offer to return. Does that sound familiar?
I don't remember when the offer took place.
That I have it down as August 1996.
I think that was the first time they were talking about that.
Okay. Well, anyway, if you do you remember what the response was with the initial offer to return?
We didn't like it. It was one of those things where we wanted to continue to fight the strike, and what they wanted us to do at that point was to do an offer return. What it is an unconditional offer to return to work. And we didn't do it in August of 96. That actually took place in February of 97. But they started talking about it in August of 96. But we managed to hold off until February of 97. And at that point, what we did is we did another thing that was incredible. We had 100,000 people. We had what was called Action Motown 97. And we brought 100,000 people to Detroit, and we had a big rally, and it was a big labor weekend that weekend. And that was when we won our unfair labor practice charges. It was the 2 days before that rally, they announced that we won our labor board charges. But we actually lost one, too. There was two important ones, and one we lost and one we kept. And then there was 9 or 8 underlying charges that stood with us. But at that point, it was February 97 when we made the unconditional offer to return to work. And what the strategy behind that was that when you did that, it started the clock ticking for back pay. Mm-hmm. So when they didn't bring people back, as the longer it went, the more back pay liability that they were accumulating. So that's one of the reasons we did that. That was another attempt to get the company to move. But it took about a year for them, maybe a little longer, before all the workers that wanted to go back got their offer of a job back. But there are still probably approximately 300 people who were fired from the newspaper for strike activity that still were on the clock even after.
If you could talk a little bit more about Motown 97 and sort of what the idea, the concept behind that and what took place.
Well, that was another thing to keep a shine, a light on the labor dispute. Mm-hmm. Okay, so we had the rally, there was 100,000 people. Now, when I say 100, it's hard to say exactly how many, but there was talks of 120. The media said there was 70,000. But I know there was a lot. I mean, it was incredible. It was like the biggest thing I've ever seen in my life. We had labor leaders from around every union you could possibly think come and speak. The rally took a couple hours just to get through the speakers. Again, I think one of the reasons the labor board ruled that weekend was to make sure it was going to be a peaceful weekend. Could you?
Yes, I'm fine. Okay, we just had to pause for a moment, and then now we're back. Dan Patton and John Peralta talking about the newspaper strike on March 25th, 2013. So we were talking about Motown 97. You had a lot of people come out. And then you were saying that the ruling was that weekend.
Yeah, and that was really a crucial point because I think the labor board actually moved up the ruling to make sure that we had, everyone was worried that there was going to be a lot of violence and things like that, but the union, that was never the union's plan to have any kind of violence. But of course, people always accused us of that kind of thing. But anyway, we got the ruling and that was kind of cool. And I believe they did it then to make sure that it cooled any kind of violence down that would have taken place with 100,000 people in the town, you know, because a lot of people were appalled when they seen, one of the things I did, and I'm going to get this to you, is I did a 14-minute video of the strike, and it was actually a lot of footage that took place. The beginning shows you the police brutality, But then the other part showed you some of the other things we were doing, and we had some strikers in there, and it was a way to get money from different unions to help support our strike. But the one thing that the Motown did for us is it brought a lot of financial support, because unions, you know, re-upped and continued to help us. Because no matter what anyone says, you have to have a lot of money to fight a company like this. And it's very important. And we continued getting people to finance us. We actually had people send money to our local for years during this battle. Individuals just kept sending money to help us because they wanted to make sure we won, you know. There's other things that happened that I didn't even touch on, and I'm not going to have time to really go over it all. But there was things like we did what was called scab walks. Did you hear anybody talk to you about those?
If you have time to talk about it, or we could...
I'll just give you a quick synopsis of what happened. What we would do is we would go to certain people's homes. One of the big ones we went to was Mitch Albom. He crossed our picket line. He was a very big writer of the Detroit newspapers. He worked for the Free Press. And we thought that Mitch didn't have to cross the picket line. This guy was independently wealthy already. He could have stayed out, and it would have been really a big thing for him to do. So we would go to certain people's homes, and we would march in front of their homes with, you know, a couple hundred people, and let the neighbors know that their neighbor was a scab. And that's basically what we did. Then there was times when we went to some of the company executives' homes and did the same thing. So, you know, we kept a lot of pressure on the company by doing these different actions. And
so what was the feeling then when the there was the denial of the 10J injunction?
That was very horrible. That hurt us really bad when we lost that. Because of 10J, if we had won it, it would have forced them to take us all back, regardless if they wanted to or not. And that was way before any decision came down. But by the 10J court not going through, that put another damper on the strike. You know, as far as it kept the strike longer. Because if they would have given us the 10J, then they would have forced them to negotiate with us, because everything up to that point was replacement workers were back in there, and now they would have been forced to bring us back and get rid of their replacement workers. Or they could have kept them, but they would have definitely been behind us. But when you made the unconditional offer, the difference was that we came in as openings occurred. So the 10J hurt us really bad. And unfortunately, the funny thing about that was it was a Democrat that did not give us the 10J. It wasn't a Republican, it was a Democrat. And people would think, oh, the Democrat would be more likely to help you. But at that point, he didn't.
So at what point did it start to feel like, you know, things weren't really going to come out the way that everyone was hoping? You know, what,
you know, I personally never felt that way. I always thought positive, trying to shine a light that we were going to be successful. Unfortunately, I think, and I don't remember when the ruling came down, must have been sometime in 1999, I think, when the actual District Court of Washington, D.C. District Court, mm-hmm. ruled against and took away all our labor board charges. Mm-hmm. And I think that was the fall of 99. Yeah, I believe that's when it took place, somewhere around there. But that really, you know, first it was the 10J, and then the Washington, D.C. Court of Appeals threw every single charge, unfair labor practice charge, out. Now, by that time, all the workers were back in that wanted to go back in, except for the fired workers that the company wouldn't take back. at that point, the strike should have been over. But here's the piece that's very important for people to understand. The courts are rigged. They're just not going to help you. They're not set up for the working person. There are cases that are good for the working people, but in general, the courts are rigged in favor of the corporation. So in order to succeed in a strike like this, you have to have a very effective economic attack against the company. And history should have went down and they should have said, you know what, strike's over, we broke the unions, goodbye. But guess what? Because our boycott was so effective, because we were so successful in getting people to stop buying the newspaper and advertisers not to advertise, at this point they still had to negotiate with us to get a settlement in order for us to stop our boycott. And all through the strike, they kept acting like the strike or the boycott meant nothing. But that was the single reason that we were successful in 2000. Now, the contracts weren't great, and they would have been a lot better if we would have won our labor board charges, but we still have workers there today, unionized workforce in that plant, and if it wasn't for the boycott, you wouldn't have any workers in there today. Because like I said, historically, it should have went down in history that the unions lost because we lost all our cases in the courts. You know, that was a lot of money. And if we would have won, they would have been forced to pay a lot of back pay and things like that. But it was a hurt. But the thing that really saved us was the boycott. And the minute that we got a contract, and I know that this was a very crucial piece, was we had a bulletin board, or it was not a bulletin board, it was a big board that was, are you familiar with the ASME building downtown? Mm-hmm. Well, right across the street from the ASME building is the Detroit newspapers. And we put up a billboard, like, I think it was 8 by 16 foot. And it said, circulation down 35%. And every day, those executives were looking out their window at that billboard. Well, when we finally got a settlement, Tim Kelleher from the company called my office, and he said, when are you guys gonna get that billboard down? And we said, well, we'll get it down. You know, we're gonna go over there. Well, within an hour of that phone call, he sent some of his people across the street and had them dismantle billboard. Yeah, not a bulletin board, it's a billboard. It looked like a big billboard. But this man was looking out his windows every day at this billboard that said that. It was just driving him crazy. So in 2000, we finally got a settlement all the unions could live with, and our membership approved it. And moments after the settlement, he called that Monday morning, because we did it on a Sunday, and asked about this sign. And we said we would get it down this week. Well, it wasn't quick enough for him. He went and brought his guys from across the street and went up there, and they dismantled it and brought that sign down. And then on top of it, Susie Elwood, who was the spokesperson, got on the TV stations and wound up telling everybody about the settlement, and finally there's been a settlement, and now we can get rid of the boycott and all that stuff. Well, if it wasn't for the boycott, I don't ever think we would have gotten back in there with contracts. I think it just wouldn't have happened. And thank God for that. And that was the community support. And that's the most important piece that you can have in any kind of effort when you have a strike going, your community support. You have to be able to be successful and hurt the revenue. If you're not, so the thing is, you know, the newspapers, they wanted to brag that they won the strike, and technically the contracts weren't that great, and we went back for less than what we would have been if we wouldn't have went on strike. But the sad thing is, they lost, by that time, they were down to 700,000 newspapers, you know, went from 1,000,002 to 700,000. Now they lost 500,000 circulation. They lost advertisers for good that they'll never get back. And they had a black eye in the community because a lot of people to this day will not buy that newspaper. And I mean, I'm not exaggerating. There's still people that have signs up at their homes at different areas. You will see those. That was something we didn't talk about either, but we had yard signs everywhere that said no news or free press wanted here or no scab papers. And it was just a horrible, horrible thing. But the best thing it did is it brought the labor community together. And I'm telling you that at that point it was very valuable because the labor community became one again. And it was something that you couldn't even do today, because the problem you have today is a lot of the people that were helping us have been laid off since. You know, they lost their jobs.
One last question. I was doing some research about you specifically, I saw that there was an online newspaper, the World Socialist Web or something.
Yeah.
And they wrote a story, and I saw that you wrote a response to that, and I was just wondering if you remember anything about that and can talk about that.
Yeah. They blasted the unions that we lost the strike. And I thought that was pretty horrible that they did that. And they didn't really take into consideration all the things in the corporation we were going up against. You know, because Gannett at the time had $85, a stock cost $85, okay? And they were like making mega, mega millions. They were just very big. So going up against them was like going up against somebody that had an endless amount of money. And the unions obviously don't have that kind of money, but even though we didn't, we were still very successful in doing a lot of the different things. But you know what? I can't remember what I said to them, but I did write to them and I told them that you people don't even really know what you're talking about. Something like that. And that it would have been really nice if you would have talked to somebody who was involved in it. Yeah, those people, you know, their attitude was you shut the company down and that's it. You don't do anything else. Unfortunately, that's unrealistic, especially with somebody that's as big as Gannett. Now today, that newspaper is only $15 a share. So they're a lot more vulnerable than they were in 95. And also, there was another corporation called Knight Ridder that was their partner. So Knight Ridder today doesn't even exist. It sold every newspaper. Oh, and this is another thing that's important, and there's so much things, and probably we might have to get together again when you go through all this stuff, but Gannett bought the Free Press, the failing newspaper. See, the JOA's premise was that the Detroit News was the successful newspaper and the Free Press was the failing newspaper, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I can't remember exactly when they bought it, but somewhere around 2004 or 3, the Gannett bought the Detroit Free Press from Knight Ridder. Knight Ridder sold that paper to him.
Mm-hmm.
Gannett then, through liquidation, gave it to a company called Media News. And they actually reformed the JOA. Now, you might want to look into when they reformed that JOA, because this is another crucial piece. Because the original JOA that was taking place in 1987 was for 99 years. But the new JOA brought it to only 25 years. So, and I think, I can't remember when that took place. It was somewhere around 2003 to 2005 that they bought the Free Press. Now, when you think about that, they bought the failing newspaper. Well, it was never the failing newspaper. It was all a smokescreen for them to get the joint operating agreement. Because the truth was, the Detroit News was always the one that was in jeopardy of going down because people didn't want an afternoon paper. The news was afternoon, Free Press was morning. So And during the times I worked at the news, because that was my main job, they were transitioning their newspaper to go to all morning. They still had an afternoon presence, but it was mainly originally an afternoon paper. So the funniest thing is, 1987, the news is the dominant paper. Free Press is supposed to be the failing paper. Not even 10 years later, Gannett buys Knight Ridder's newspaper. And then right after that, Knight Ridder sold their whole chain. And they were the smart ones because they got out of the newspaper industry at the time before the real bad stuff started happening.
One last question. So when Local 372 and Local 2040 were on strike, obviously they didn't end up outsourcing. Who was brought in to replace those jobs?
Oh, they brought in replacement workers. In my union, in Local 2040s, we only had 9 people out of the 300 cross the picket line. It was pretty good. I don't know how many crossed the picket line in 372, but they probably had the same kind of percent because they had they represented between 1,300 and 1,400 at the time. So we represented 300 and something full-time, plus another 400 part-time. 9 people crossed the picket line. Only, I'm going to say around 100 crossed their picket line. So theoretically, the support we got from our own members was incredible.
And how many ended up, we may have mentioned this, but how many ended up going back to work?
Out of my union, I think only 100 or so went back, maybe 125. I don't know exactly. It's because it took 5 years, and a lot of people by that time had moved on to other jobs. But we were successful. We were one of the few unions that was successful in getting 30 of our fired workers back. There was, I think, 40 or so total, and 10 of them they refused to take back. And 30 when they did take back. But they only, out of the 30 that they would take back, only 14 actually took their jobs. And the other 10, only one out of the 10 would have possibly went back. The other 10 people we talked to, and they said they didn't want their jobs anyway, and to take a settlement for them, and they got a settlement and left. But we did talk to all those people. Now, the one person that possibly could have wanted his job back was the guy that we won $1.25 million for. And he said he wanted to go back, but I don't know if he really did. Because it's not easy to go back when you're, in a situation where you're working with a lot of replacement workers that you never worked with before. But I did go back myself for a short period of time until I got my new job in 2003. I went back in 1998, and I worked there part-time. I couldn't go in there full-time anymore. I used to be full-time and worked part-time for the union. At that point, I was full-time for the union, so I could only work part-time for the company. And then it took me 7 years to get another job, but I finally did.
All right. I guess we'll wrap it up there, then.
Yeah. Yeah, and if
anything else?
No, if there's anything else you need, as far as any other questions that come up, if you go through this and something that makes sense to you, just you can call me.